Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
And you're very welcome along to Thursday night's football show. It's Richie McCormack here with you in studio. Thanks to Steve McManaman and to Nathan and to Kenny down at the Aviva. We are keeping an eye on events in the Europa League tonight, the first legs of the semi-finals into the second half in both instances, in both North London and in Germany tonight. It's Arsenal 2, Valencia 1 at the Emirates. It was Mukhtar Diakabi that put Valencia 1-0 up after just 11 minutes after some woeful Arsenal defending, it must be said. Arsenal have gotten themselves back on the front foot. Alexandre Lacazette with a brace of goals within 6 minutes of one another, 8 minutes of one another, pardon me, in the first half, putting Arsenal 2-1 ahead. Heading into the break and into the second half, it remains the same score. Luka Jovic, a much sought after striker around Europe, put Eintracht Frankfurt ahead at home to Chelsea after just 23 minutes, but Pedro equalised in the stroke of half time. 56 minutes played there in Germany still. Eintracht Frankfurt 1, Chelsea 1. And as an added bonus tonight as well, given events that have gone on at the Aviva, I'm delighted to say that Thursday Night Football has been moved to the football show, and John Giles joins us in studio. Good evening, John.
Evening, Richie.
Thank you so much for coming in.
No bother.
And I'm just glad that we've all got the pulses back down to normal after what's been a fairly,
yes,
fairly rigidly entertaining couple of nights football, particularly last night at the Camp Nou with Barcelona and Liverpool. I'm not sure anybody could argue that it was a 3-0 scoreline in terms of performances, but Barcelona very much have the upper hand going into the next
year. They've got three goals up, Richie, which is a big bonus going into the second leg. I think what you said there, I mean, I don't think it was a 3-0 performance as far as Liverpool was concerned. I think it's on the 90 minutes that was played, it definitely, they didn't get out of the game what they should have got out of.
Slightly harsh on them.
Yeah, well, again, you know, you got Messi coming into it, as we know. You never know what Messi's going to do. He's usually brilliant. But I thought up to the, when Barcelona went to front, went 1-0, in the second half, if I'd have been a betting man, I'd have bet in Liverpool getting the next goal. They had a few chances, they were well on top, and then from nothing, really, Barcelona came in and scored a second goal, and then the wonder goal by Messi to make it 3. I wouldn't write Liverpool off, Richie.
Yeah,
at all.
I'm
not saying anybody is, but it wasn't a 3-0 game where they were well on top, dominated the game. It wasn't the case. I mean, they did get the three goals, obviously, but Liverpool had their chances. In general play, they more than matched them over the 90 minutes.
It was pointed out, if we're looking for kind of signifiers of what might come next week, Kieran Cunningham from The Star pointed out earlier on, we mentioned this in the newsroom, that in the away legs of their Champions League exits last year and in 2017, Barcelona conceded 3 goals in each of those exits, and they didn't score away from home in either of those exits either, including the one the year previous as well in 2016. So they have form of letting leads like this disappear off into the smoke.
It can happen, you know. I mean, 3-0 is a big lead, as we know. And if you look at it the other way from Barcelona, if they score, right, that's 4. Liverpool are going to score 5 if they happen to score it, which is it looks all over on paper. But in a game, and I remember when I was young, I was saying, look, it only takes 10 seconds to score a goal sometimes. So I wouldn't write Liverpool off by any means. I'm not saying anybody's writing them off, but I certainly wouldn't, because goal early on. And I mean, where Barcelona really slipped up, I mean, the two great chances when Liverpool were looking for the away goal, was Dembele, wasn't he, have the two?
Dembele when he came on as a sub, yeah.
Yeah, two chances. I mean, two great chances to really finish it off. So that was a break for Liverpool. But it has happened to Liverpool before. It's happened to other teams before, that they do lose a 3-goal lead. It can happen.
Did Liverpool's setup last night surprise you? A lot of eyebrows may have been raised when they saw Joe Gomez starting at right full instead of Trent Alexander-Arnold. Alexander-Arnold, throughout the course of the season, I think he's got the joint most assists in the Premier League at the moment. Him and Andy Robertson are almost in a competition with one another to set up goals during the course of the Premier League season. Alexander-Arnold was left on the bench. Joe Gomez was preferred up front. I know Roberto Firmino was carrying a knock, so that would explain him being left on the bench. But
I can't even understand that, Richie, to be quite honest. Anyway, but to get back to Gomez, I think Gomez is a better player than Alexander. But I don't think he's match fit. He wasn't match fit last night, that's for sure. He is a very, very good player. I don't know what, but I think he's a better defender. But
I think the theory on him is he's usually better centre-half than he is a right full. And I think that's where Liverpool perhaps see Gomez going forward as being a partner for
yeah,
Van Dijk.
Yeah, but going forward is going forward, which you...
No, but I mean in the future, that's where they see him playing.
Yeah, but that doesn't make any... It doesn't say why you played it right back last night. I think he's a very, very good player. I think he's a better right back than the other lad. But I didn't think he was fit. I didn't think he's match fit, which he's been out for a long time, and it's very difficult to get your match fitness straight away. But he didn't let the team down by any means. You know, the first goal was probably Van Dijk. And the goalkeeper.
People,
nobody's
mentioned
the goalkeeper, Richie. The goalkeeper was very bad. Because when they got down the left wing, if you notice, the goalkeeper dived out, right? The goalkeeper's got to make the right decision. The left back's on the ball, he's switched across. If he lets the ball go past him, or if the ball goes past him, there was nobody there at the far post to get it, right? So the only danger was Suarez. And he goes diving out. If you watch the goal again, he's dived out behind Suarez, and Suarez is knocking it into an empty goal. He'd been better off holding his ground, because if Suarez misses the ball going across the box, it doesn't make any difference anyway.
And if he stays in his line, he gives Suarez something extra to think about.
He could have blocked it.
Yeah.
You know, he might have hit him. It might have done anything. I think he made a very, very bad mistake, the goalkeeper. Actually, he didn't do very well for the second goal either. And Van Dijk definitely should have covered. Was it Matip was in that position?
Yeah.
You know, should have covered him. But anyway, that was the way it's...
But it's those fine margins, ultimately, that do separate games. Because we saw, like, during the course of the game, it's literally toe-to-toe. There's not an inch given. It's basically going to take a tiny little error like that for somebody to profit.
Well, I wouldn't call that a tiny...
But it's
goalkeeper's job. If it was goalkeeper's job to do it, in my opinion, and definitely it was... You know, Suarez was definitely got behind Matip, but Van Dijk was there.
To cover.
That's what he's there for. You know, to go with him. I think he was trying to play offside. But anyway, that's by the way. But it was too easy a goal really to concede from Liverpool's point of view. But then again, but Suarez did take it well. But over the 90 minutes, especially in the second half, the first 20 minutes, 20 odd minutes of the second half. Liverpool were definitely the better team.
So plenty of hope for them in the second half.
Yeah, I wouldn't write them off at all, Richie.
The one thing that came to mind yesterday, it was a strange day sporting-wise, because you saw just before we went on air last night, Ruby Walsh, the great jockey, decided to retire. Like he'd umpteen victories, I think 59 victories at Cheltenham, three Grand Nationals. The numbers in his column are just unbelievable. But the theory is to appreciate these great sports stars while we still have them, because we don't know when they're not going to be there.
Exactly.
And Walsh decided on his terms that literally the Punchdown Gold Cup yesterday was going to be his final race. In the same instance, we kind of can't ever take Lionel Messi for granted. And I think last night showed that as well, because he's just exceptional. I'm trying to think of somebody who's been that exceptional for that long and that reliable. Because even on his most middling days, Maradona could kind of slink into the background and decide he doesn't fancy it. But the consistency of Lionel Messi over the last, it was 14 years to the day that he scored his first goal for Barcelona, the first of his 600.
Yeah.
He's just incredible.
He's brilliant. I mean, I never go along with the best ever, because there's other players went before him. I mean, he's up there with the best ever. You can only go on more class players. But you see, people would be young enough only to see Messi and Ronaldo, which is, and they say they're the best player they've ever seen.
Not a bad era to be going through.
No, it's great. But there's been great players before. I mean, you go back, I'm going back a long time now, when Di Stefano played with Puskas at Real Madrid, and they won the first, nobody saw them play, and conditions weren't as good either, by the way.
There's no
the pitch
wasn't as good as
it. You know, so you can only go on what you see at any particular time. But when I'm asked who's the best player ever, I don't really answer it. Messi is up there. Ronaldo is up there. Puskas is up there. Di Stefano is up there. What's the Argentinian lad?
Maradona.
Maradona would be up there. You know.
What do you think watching a Messi performance like last night? Like, what's going through your head as you're watching him and you see free kicks on the left line?
I'm always fascinated by him, by what he does. And funny enough, last night, Richie, over the 90 minutes, it wasn't his best performance. by a long way. Now, the papers get carried away because he scored a wonder goal and a very good goal. And they were very, very important in the context of the game, obviously. But I've seen Messi play better than that. You know, well, we all have. But it was so dramatic in what he did, because, like, in that first 20 minutes, 25 minutes of the second half, actually, he wasn't in the game at all. It wasn't one of his best games overall that I've ever seen from Messi. It was just that it was so dramatic that he scored him at such an important time, and particularly the second goal was one of the best I've ever seen from a free kick. Never likely to see, I think. So that was Messi. But, you know, in many ways we've got used to Messi and expect him to do it, right? Which is phenomenal, and he usually comes up with it. I think he's brilliant. He's definitely one of the best players ever. I love watching him play. I think he's a great player. He's a real team player.
His attitude is something that strikes me that you'd enjoy.
Great. Lovely. Yeah. I mean, Messi never plays for himself. He just does it the way it should be done. And he's a player, probably the best I've ever seen at picking out the right pass. And what I mean by that, even if it's only a simple one, it's usually the right one. You know what I mean? He doesn't turn, like say a simple pass is on, that's the right ball. He doesn't turn on it and try to be dramatic or say, that's not good enough for me. He's like all the great players. If it's simple, it's simple. Just do the simple things when it's simple. And then don't go out of your way to use your ability. The time will come when you have to do that. So he's not a show off. He's a team player. He's great. I think he's terrific. And what is he now, 32, is he?
In around that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think players at 32, I hear people when they get to 30 and... those great players are usually at their best at 32, 33 even, 34. It depends how long they can hang on to their fitness. Their ability gets better, their knowledge of the game gets better. So the other thing is a physical thing, and obviously he looks after himself very well because he wouldn't be able to do what he does. So when he gets to that age, actually, they get better, those players.
You get cuter in the head, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's all experience. See, what I found with football, in my experience of football, you should learn from every match, and you never learn at all. But in my experience, learn from every match. So when you get to 31, 32, 33, you've learned a lot. And every game you play, you learn something. You never finish learning in football, ever finished. You know, but there's always something. There's 101 different things that you can learn, all small things. So in Messi's case, like obviously he thinks about the game. So the older he's getting, the better he becomes. Because what you find with the stamina situation is that you don't waste any energy. You learn from it. Don't make a silly run over there. So you're keeping it tight all the time, you know?
You're playing half the game up there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I've got my own limited experience now in relation to, I found as I got older, I didn't waste a step. You know, when I was younger, you'd make a run over there and you learn, that's not the place to go. So, but now I was a midfield player. But you learned, don't do that. So now you're saving your energy all the time. And it's called knowledge of the game. Yeah. But there again, see, there's lots of fellas who get 31, 32, who don't learn anything about the game, Richie.
And they're still running around like headless chickens.
Yeah. Like there's an old saying in football, like lads who like Messi, like when Messi was a very young fella, in his first season, like he played like a lad who'd been playing for 10 years, right? And then you get lads who don't think about it. After 10 years, they look like a guy who's only playing the first year. So they never learn from it, you know? But you can see in Messi's case, like the older he gets, and as long as he can keep himself fit, he'll actually get better. As long as he has the will to do it, and he obviously has that at the moment. You know, a lot of players at his age now...
They start thinking about winding down. Yeah, start thinking about winding down, and he's just not...
Yeah, they say, well, I've had enough of it. He's very lucky, I think, in that he recognises that he's a great player and he has to make the most of what he was or has. Because what you'd find with the likes of Messi, he doesn't want to retire with any regrets. In other words, I've done the best I can with the ability that I've had. I've done the best I can. And then he can live the rest of his life mentally.
Contented soul.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll get to Ajax and Tottenham because so many talking points alone in that game and of that second leg to come in Amsterdam in a moment as well. And we'll talk about Leeds and where their promotion challenge lies as well. All to come with John after these.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back to the Football Show. It's Richie McCormack here with you. Just to update you, it's still Eintracht Frankfurt 1, Chelsea 1 in the Europa League semi-final first leg. And at the Emirates, Arsenal still leading Valencia by 2-1. And still to come on the Football Show, we'll be talking John Caulfield's departure from Cork as well, with Stewie Byrne, who'll be back in studio with us. John Giles is in studio at the moment. We're just talking off air about Tottenham and Ajax. That one's obviously very delicately poised heading into the second leg. And you mentioned Spurs, kind of their home record in Europe, not as great as it really should be, I guess. I know Wembley has played a part in that to a degree because they were quote-unquote home games up until the last few weeks. But getting away to the Amsterdam Arena, having Heung-Min Son back in the side, you can only imagine we're going to see a better Spurs performance in the second leg.
Oh, yeah. We're talking off camera there. What could be expected? If you look at the results, they contradict what I regard as a myth about the home and away record. The away record is fantastic. The home record is not good at all, because I always thought it was a myth. You know, playing away from home was a myth in many ways, I found, because they used to say the hostile crowd. Now, as a professional footballer, in my experience, the crowd don't come into it, right? When you're playing, and this was always my philosophy playing in a away match, a big away match, the ball's the same, the pitch is the same, the goalposts are the same, right? The only thing that's different is the crowd and how the away crowd can affect the referee's decisions, whether it's near the penalty or not. That's the only thing. You know, there used to be a thing years ago, when you played against Liverpool, the Cop, they sucked the ball into the back of the net. It was a load of rubbish. I know from playing, if I got the ball in the centre circle, I was playing with Leeds and Eddie Gray was on the left wing, the crowd couldn't stop me from hitting the ball from there out to Eddie Gray, right? Yeah. They can influence the crowd. So, if you have the right mentality, you can turn the away disadvantage into an advantage. Because if you go and play well and you get a goal in front, what happens with the home crowd is they turn on the home team. So you can make it work in your favour. Now, I'm only getting the roundabout way to getting back to the Ajax team, that the home record's not good. So there must be some lads in that team who are not comfortable playing at home.
Yeah.
Because when you're playing at home, actually, there's sometimes more pressure on you than playing away. Because if you make a couple of bad passes at home, the crowd get onto you. You make a couple of bad passes away from home, and the crowd are delighted. So it's a mixture. Now, again, when you look at their record, the home record hasn't been good, so there might be one or two or three players in that team who are more comfortable playing away from home.
Yeah, we only have to look at their performances in Turin and at the Bernabeu to show that away from home, Ajax play with their tails up and show no fear away from home.
Exactly.
But back in Amsterdam, they can be a bit cagey. The main talking point to come out of that game...
It mightn't even be cagey, Richie. It might be that lack of confidence to get on the ball, whereas away from home, to get on the ball, they lose it, nobody cares. Playing at home, because mostly when you play home, you're expected to win, right? And I always found with crowds, the crowds only really get behind you, really behind it when you're winning.
I want to touch on the emotive talking point to come from that game, which was the head injury suffered by Jan Vertonghen. Tottenham said that he hasn't suffered a concussion, but he will see a neurologist and he'll be given a couple of days to recover. And they say they followed all the FA protocols correctly as regards how head injuries would be treated, both on pitch and off pitch, subsequently when you're substituted. But everybody would have been worried watching the scenes that unfolded on, Tuesday night, when Vertonghen decided, you know, with the group decision among the doctors, the medical staff, that he was going to play on. And then a minute later, he's heading off and he's losing his footing and he's vomiting on the sideline. Those are worrying scenes and stuff that it's obviously raised a debate about how head injuries are treated in football. And clearly there needs to be more independent input into how these things are treated.
Well, I think it's simple enough to cure, Richie, that if you got an independent top man for head injuries on the sideline who has nothing to do with either team, then he makes an independent judgment.
Like a UEFA appointee, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, like, if it's the Spurs home doctor, he's only human. He can be, you know, persuaded, like, to let the lad to play on. He might be very friendly with the manager, that the manager wants him to play. All these type of things. Now, I don't know. We don't know what the situation was the other night. But whoever made the decision, or whoever makes the decision in that, should be totally a top man who's totally independent for both teams.
I think the issue probably what it is that we can only assume that the doctor is working within, you know, medical guidelines and all that.
Yes.
The unfortunate thing is he probably didn't have enough time to adequately work through what he needed to do. Like, ultimately, what you want to see is Vertonghen probably takes 5 minutes to go down into the dressing room, away from the hubbub of the crowd and the manager being on the sideline, get a Davinson Sanchez on, a substitute, whoever, to come on for the 5 minutes, essentially have a what will be a blood sub in rugby, to have a concussion sub or a head injury sub in football, temporary, see if the guy's okay, let him back on, have the other guy back off. But it seems like an easy fix.
Well, I don't know if it's that simple. If there's a doubt whatsoever, I mean, even with the best specialist might not be able to diagnose what's wrong with the lad on the pitch. I think the best thing, if there's any doubt whatsoever, he goes off for the...
Yeah, get them down the dressing room and have a...
No, leave them off.
And leave them off entirely?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's not worth the risk to bring the player back, in my opinion. If there's any doubt and he's gone off for 5 minutes...
Yeah, but if he's gone off under, not just for 5 minutes, but he's having constant supervision through that time, there's a doctor with him going through checks, having the adequate kind of, you know, asking him questions, checking his eyes, all this kind of stuff that you would do. I mean, if you fell in the garden and you went to the doctor and the doctor was like checking you out, you wouldn't expect him to go, what's your name? Where are you? Grand, you know how to change shorts? Go back out, you're fine. Like, done in a minute, you'd be worried.
No, but what you seem to be saying, Richard, if he takes the 5 minutes off, then he can go back on again.
But only if he's after being cleared by the doctor.
Yeah, but the doctor's only got 5 minutes to do it. I mean, if there's any doubt whatsoever, even with the top doctor, that if he's that bad enough to take off into the dressing room, leave him off altogether. I think it's quite simple. Mm. Okay, so he's not playing for the rest. But isn't it better to be totally sure?
Looking after the mental health down the line as well.
Exactly. So that's. I think it's quite simple in that particular way. Any doubt whatsoever. Like Vertonghen got a bad knock. Right? Who knows he's going to be in 5 minutes? They assumed that he would, but he wasn't. But take him off anyway. So what? So he misses half a game. Isn't it better doing missing half a game than coming back on and he's not quite right, even with the best
of medical supervision,
treatment?
Very quickly, I want to touch on Leeds. We saw rather remarkable circumstances unfold on Sunday. Patrick Bamford's gotten himself a 2-game ban today for his actions, and probably deservedly so, for his dive from El Ghazi. I don't know if you've seen anything like that before and what your general thoughts on it were. And if, you know, Leeds, having been in that top two for so long, the theory usually is if you sink back into the playoffs, you probably aren't going to get out of the playoffs. I don't know how you see this one going.
Well, I don't think that had anything to do with what actually happened on the pitch. I think what actually happened on the pitch was very, very simple, Richie. All you've got to do is obey the rules, right? Now, the rule is that if a player goes down injured, it's the referee's decision whether he stops the play or doesn't stop the play, right? That's the rule. Mm. Now, what happened with the players the other night, apparently in the first half, when one of the Leeds players went down, the Villa player knocked it out of play. That's because he wanted to knock it out of play, which is very gentlemanly and right. He didn't have to, right? It's the referee's decision, right? Now, in the second half, when Leeds didn't respond in the same way, don't forget the referee played on.
He did.
The referee didn't say anything was wrong. There was actually nothing wrong with doing it. It was a moral, if that's the right word.
Yeah, it would be.
A moral situation, okay? But there's a lot of the hypocrisy comes into this now. I think, you know, that there should be the rule is you keep playing until the referee says it. So you don't expect anybody to stop the play.
Take the discretionary element out of it.
Take discretionary out of it. You just play on, right? And the referee decides, that's his job to do it, right? And that didn't happen. And the Villa players went mad because they did it and Leeds didn't do it. So the rules are there. All you've got to do is obey the rules, Rich. It's not complicated. Keep playing.
Yeah.
Either team, referee could tell him before, I'll make the decision. If a player goes down injured, you don't have to knock the ball out of play. I'll make the decision on that. Mm. Now, what happened was Villa knocked the ball out of play and Leeds didn't. So a lot of the players were on the moral high ground. We did it and you didn't do it, right? Now, at the same time, some of those players playing with that attitude, right?
Yeah.
Are going down, pretending to be injured, to get the other players sent off. And we're seeing that a lot.
Constantly,
as you know, a lot. Now, they'd be the same players that took the high ground that you didn't knock it out. Mm. And all the referees have to, it's very, very simple. Obey the rules.
Yeah. We've a long road to travel.
I think in the end, I think the manager was right to do what he did. Because Leeds did get an advantage.
Yeah.
on it because the players did stop. But what I'm saying is it's become part of the game. Sometimes the players knock the ball out. Sometimes they don't knock the ball out.
Yeah.
But it's not against the rules of the game not to knock it out. It's the referee's decision. It's not the player's decision. It's quite simple.
Okay, John. It's been a pleasure as always.
Okay, Richard.
We'll get Leeds up eventually one of these days.
Getting carried away.
It's grand. It's an emotive subject all around. Still, Chelsea 1, Eintracht Frankfurt 1, Arsenal 2-1 up back after this.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back to the final part of the football show. It's Richie back here in studio, and I've dragged Stewie Byrne in away from the live football as well, back in here this evening, because I suppose between yesterday with the spate of retirements that we had with Ruby Walsh retiring, Paul Flynn retiring, and everybody else was pretty much quitting the game all at once, we also had John Caulfield walking away after 5 years at Cork City, which to some may have come as a surprise, I guess, not necessarily given the run of results that they'd had, which is 7 games without a win. But John had been such an integral part of that club, both as a player and now as a manager for the past 5 years, and linked to the success that they've had over that course of time, that to see him walk away seems like a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I don't think this is like a normal termination or a manager leaving a club. You know, normally when a club has a very, very poor run of results, the way Cork have had, especially Cork, because when you consider where they were for the last 4 or 5 years, when they had those poor results, the manager walks away, people aren't really surprised. And like in this case, not necessarily surprised, but it's a little bit more complicated due to the fact that he had done such a wonderful job with the club, and his sort of the fact that he's part of the furniture down there almost, so I think people are looking at this one slightly different. I think he's walking away with people saying, you know what, he did a fantastic job. They're saying, yeah, it probably is time for it to go. Something is not right. You can't get rid of 15 players, you know. So normally in these situations, it's the manager that walks away. So it's a mixed emotions, but I think it's definitely the right one. I mean, I would imagine the board probably gave him a couple of weeks longer than they would have given anybody else. I'd say probably a month longer than they would have given anybody else, you know.
The timing of it for me surprised me a little bit, because it came off the back of that Finn Harps draw on Monday night. Caulfield has always been somebody who's not afraid to front up to the media. He had his press conference as normal after the game on Monday. He was back in front of the microphones then the next morning, and he was saying that he intended to be in the dugout. That was early part of this week to say he was going to be in the dugout for that game of Bohemians on Friday. Something clearly changed between Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, you would have thought that there was conversations with the club. I would imagine the club probably would have gone to him with a proposition to step down. I mean, this seems to be the way these things are done now. Instead, you know, you don't want to be sacking a manager, do you, really? Like, you know, you want to have an open conversation and say, look, this is not happening. See what the other party has to say. And I would imagine from those talks, they came to some sort of an agreement that suits everybody, you know.
There was a couple of things before he stepped down that stood out in terms of what he was saying in his press conferences. The one that came in the immediate aftermath of that draw with Finn Harps was, like, he pointed towards it being a massive cut in budgets. I don't think that was any secret to anybody, because of their step down from Champions League to Europa League, and they didn't progress as far as they wanted to either in the Europa League last year. That had an impact money-wise in the club. But he also mentioned a change in emphasis and where the club want to go.
Yeah, I've got an issue with this, Richie, and, you know, John has been harping on about this for quite a while now. I mean, it's not a secret to anybody that the budget has been cut, and it's not a secret to anybody because John has been talking about it pretty much for the last six to eight months.
Is that a lower, like, this where he wanted to lower expectations?
I think he's always done this, Richie, and this is where I kind of have a bit of a problem. I think he's always done that since he's gotten the job. I mean, when you look back at Cork and their rise to the top, it happened extremely quickly. You know, at the time, we're talking 4 or 5 years ago.
There were 6 or 7 Dundalk.
They were the only club putting pressure on Dundalk. And I don't think that happened very, very quickly for him and for the club. And obviously, they didn't expect that to happen. But they found themselves in a scenario where they were going head-to-head with Dundalk for the last 4 or 5 years. So it was just a situation that they had to, you know, take on board. They had to deal with it because the competition coming from, you know, you have to be critical of Shamrock Rovers and, you know, Pats, Derry, the other clubs. They just weren't at the races. So Cork found themselves in this scenario very, very quickly. Wasn't expected, but they had to deal with it. You know, had to deal with the hits as they came. I've always felt they were never comfortable there, Richie, and I always felt he was never comfortable there. When you look at the likes of Stephen Kenny, and very, very similar thing happened with Stephen with Dundalk. You know, put together a squad of players in late 2012 over the course of about 6 or 8 weeks. That following season, his maiden season, they ran Pats all the way to the title, fell off just at the end, finished second. Subsequently went on and won the league the next year. I think the difference between Stephen and John is that Stephen was comfortable in that scenario. He embraced it. He said, you know what? We are the best team in the league. We're going to push on. We want to do well in Europe. You know, and he always accentuated the positive. My issue with John is that he didn't, I don't think he was ever comfortable being at the top, okay, being expected to push for league titles, being expected to say, Europe, we have to progress. And I always felt he had a difficulty with that. And he didn't know how to articulate that to, I don't think he maybe understood it fully, didn't know how to articulate it to his players. And ultimately, I think this could be what's happened now, is that they've fallen off a cliff. And I think the players have,
they sure have some responsibility in this.
I think they do, but I think the players have bought it now. They've been told for so long, well, the budget's getting cut, we're not really, you know, the club doesn't want to go in this direction, and it's all, you know, it's all sort of
fed into the
negative, yeah. It's not put, and it's fed into the squad of players, and bang, it's just, this season is the culmination of that negativity, I suppose.
John Cotter's been put in temporary charge.
Yeah.
They obviously have a big appointment is going to have to come, whether that's Cotter or somebody else down further down the line. You would imagine come Friday night, Dalyman Park, there will be a response from the players, because like, one thing from watching football from countless years we've come to know is as soon as the manager goes, and I don't think that necessarily the players were the happiest there for the past while anyway,
yeah.
There's going to be a bounce in terms of performance.
Yeah, I'd wonder about that. I don't know what John Cotter's going to do for this game, how he's going to set them up. You would have thought the players might, you know, tend to, what tends to happen, Richie, is that the players feel, this is what happens, the manager goes, players go, oh thank God, it's not really our fault because the manager's gone.
Do those conversations actually happen?
I'm not pointing
the finger at you here previously.
Players are like that. Players are selfish. You know, it's me, you know, you know, that tends to be what I've experienced. Players, me, don't look after themselves, whatever. The manager's gone, that was his fault, you know, it was the way we were playing, whatever, like, you know. And that's what happens. They use that as an excuse, and then there's a fresh start. And that's why you see the bump. You see a bump, but it's never permanent. Mm. And it won't be permanent. They need to get somebody in there quick, somebody to put their ideas in, put a shape on the team, start getting certain players playing, get confidence back into the team. Who's going to go in there? Difficult one to say, because there's a complication in Ireland with this whole pro licence thing. They don't run that often. There aren't that many fully qualified pro licence coaches.
And it's not the fault of the coaches that want them.
Not the fault of the coaches, of course, yeah. But there is this complication that there used to be a scenario where if you were on a pro licence, or you were marked down to go on a pro license, you could manage, but they've gotten rid of that completely. You have to be fully qualified now, and that rules out a lot of potential coaches. You know, I mean, there are a lot of guys out there. The current pro license is probably one of the most certainly there's a hell of a lot of potential on that. You've got the likes of Damien Duff, Robbie Keane, Keith Andrews doing their pro license. Then you have Neil Fenn, who was working in the league, Vinnie Pert, who was currently at Dundalk, like, you know. So there's on top of who's already come through the system, like, you know, you've got there's a lot of potential there. I mean, I don't know who would go. You've got the likes of Kenny. I don't know whether Kenny would like to put his hat in the ring, get back into management.
Colin Healy
will be mentioned. I'm not sure if Colin has his pro license,
yeah,
does he?
Still think he's working towards that.
Yeah, I think that's so. I think the club would probably look at that one immediately and see is there anything they can work there. But that's the complication, is that you have to have your foot, you have to be fully finished as a pro license, and that's what tends to be the blocker so to speak, for clubs.
John's one of these people, he's very well spoken of in terms of how the media had a lot of time for how they were dealt with by him during the course of the last 5 years. He seems like one of these people who would be a loss to the league if he was to disappear completely. I know he's very Cork-centric in that he's so woven into the fabric of that club that you can't imagine him getting on the merry-go-round and being...
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I remember having this conversation probably a year ago with somebody else, I think it was another pundit, and, you know, we were talking about this because from the current batch of managers out there, there aren't that many that have fully bought into the full-time management thing. It's Stephen Kenny is one, John was another, possibly Keith Long. I don't know what's happening there. That may, he may move into that bracket, but these are guys who want to take on full-time management as their career. You know, a lot of people in Ireland are very fearful of going into the full-time management stuff because of what's happened in the past. And you can lose your job just like that, you know. But John was one of them. He bought into the full-time management thing. But I remember having this conversation thinking, you know, where else would he go? He's so Cork.
Yeah.
He's so Cork. Where else would he go? And he's, like you say, he's part of the Ferns, or he's been an integral part of the redevelopment. He's played there as a player.
When you look at the FAI being reorganised as it is over the next while, whatever form that may take, and we've spoken a lot about the potential that the league has to be involved in whatever new form the FAI takes, but board level. Hmm. John Caulfield, surely, if he has the desire to do it, would fit that role of somebody who's going to promote the league, who's going to work his best and his hardest to see right by the league. He'd be an ideal candidate for something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I would always look at ex-League of Ireland, I hate to say ex-League of Ireland people, people that have worked in the league for so long and have been part of the whole sort of resurgence in the game here. And there has been, you know, I think it's important to point out, there has been a big resurgence in the game, in the football part of it here. I know the clubs themselves had to get their house in order. I mean, they're very much under-resourced in terms of full-time staff, and that's a kind of separate issue. But from my point of view, what's happening on the pitch and on the training grounds and the quality, I think has come a hell of a long way. And he's been part of that, and there are other people that have, are also out there, like Pat Fenlon is out there. You've got Paul Doolan, who's out there. You've got all this experience. And they should be, in my opinion, they should be part of the new of the new structure. Like, you know, of course, that's always been a complication up until now because of the way the FAI has been run. But where's the EGM, Richie? You know, you talk about the FAI and the football is in crisis and we're supposed to be on our knees, but nothing's happening.
We're gonna have one in June, apparently, aren't we?
The AGM's an EGM in June. Well, I know the AGM's July. So we're going to have an EGM 2 weeks before the AGM, are we?
Nah, sure, we'll see.
You know, I would have thought that something would have happened by now.
I think they're waiting for those investigations and stuff to run their course, but it's probably a conversation as regards what the structure is going to be for another day. Stewie, thanks for coming in tonight.
Thanks, Richie.
Stewie Byrne there, talking about the latest in Cork. The latest from the Emirates is Arsenal 3, Valencia 1. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has gotten Arsenal third tonight, just playing stoppage time in that one. But the final whistle has gone in Germany, where it's finished on track. Frankfurt 1, Chelsea 1. That Pedro away goal just before halftime could well prove to be all important come next Thursday. That is just about our lot for tonight. Just want to tell you before we go that our green ticket winners for tonight are Breed McInerney, Colin Martin and Aisling Connors. They're all in the hat for that trip to Yokohama, and it's all with thanks to Heineken, official sponsors of 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. OTBAM, our daily sports breakfast show, is live across your social channels from 7:45 a.m. in the morning. We'll be back on the radio from 7 p.m. tomorrow. Brian O'Driscoll is going to join us. We're going to have Friday Night Racing and the Crappy Quiz back in your life as well. Thank you so much for listening for tonight. Tom Dunn's up next. Until next time, bye-bye.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.